Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by IB Cool Athleisure Wear for men and women. Technology meets fashion with IB Cool, stylish UPF 50 plus sun protection, and ice field technology to cool your body temperature on hot and humid days. Look great and protect your skin. IBKUL.com. And by Tourism Ireland. Discover world-class links and breathtaking landscapes. Experience golf where it all began. Plan your dream trip to Ireland today at ireland.com/golf. And by Aer Lingus, the Irish flag carrier. Renowned for its warm Irish hospitality and exceptional service, Aer Lingus flies to Ireland from 19 gateways across North America. For more information and to secure a great fare, visit aerlingus.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. And I've always been a fan of golf course architect Seth Rayner, who in a relatively short period of time from 1914 to his untimely death at the young age of 51 in 1926, designed over 100 courses. Just incredible. And I'm fortunate to be a member of a Seth Rayner design Southampton Golf Club right here in Southampton, New York. And what a gem that is. And so many of his designs on Long Island alone and within the New York metropolitan area. And here to talk about it is Michael Wolff. He and Jim Sitar wrote just a gorgeous book called The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. And the photographs are by John Cavalier. And first of all, Michael, just I love this book. Congratulations on this just extraordinary effort.
Thank you very much. It was I enjoyed doing it. That was something I always thought about doing. And it was, yeah, I enjoyed the process. It was fun. And I learned a lot.
How did you originally get drawn to the work of Seth Rayner?
So I grew up, like a lot of people getting their start in golf. I grew up as a caddy in Cincinnati, Ohio. Oh. At an old Langford and Moreau golf course on the west side of town. But every once in a while, the real fancy club on the other side of town, Camargo, when they would have a big tournament and they would need some extra caddies, they would call over and I would quickly raise my hand and volunteer to go over. First of all, because the pay was better over there, but also it was just a special place. It was like going to another world. Everything was just so green and manicured. And, you know, it took me a couple of times, but, you know, as I was playing more golf in this, I was 12, 13, 14 years old. It became obvious almost right away that, I'd never seen any golf courses like that, you know, whether it was the kind of squared off greens or just some of the hole designs and the bunkering. And I thought, you know, this is, you know, interesting and different than everything else I've seen. It kind of got in my head at an early age. And then, you know, just I'm a big reader. I collect golf books. I enjoy reading books. I have since I was a little kid. And my area of focus has always been on golf history, golf architecture, the men who built the courses. As anybody who's ever seen me swing a golf club knows, I'm not so much on like instruction books or biographies and things like that. I like to read about, you know, how the men and women who built these places and what was behind it. And yeah, so that was kind of the start of it. Specifically on Seth Rayner, and what led to the book was I've got probably about 3,000 golf books I'm up to now. I hope my wife's not listening, on different golf courses and different golf course architects. And the one spot missing on the shelf, as I write in the introduction, was always Seth Rayner. You know, just about every golf course architect, particularly the golden age ones, they would write books, or in a lot of cases, they were almost just like pamphlets on kind of their philosophies on golf course architecture. And in most cases, it was almost like a sales brochure. You know, they were doing it so that they could give out these copies to people. And it was a way of kind of advertising and trying to separate themselves. For Seth Rayner, he didn't need to. He was in an extremely unique position in the long history of golf course architects, which is he was busy from the day he got in the business. So, you know, from kind of starting as, you know, C.B. McDonald's protege at the National Golf Links of America. And that was, you know, well received from the moment it opened once they got the agronomy issues figured out. And it led to you know, National Golf Links, as you can tell by the title, is kind of a national club with people spending the summers in Southampton, pretty nice places, you know, to hang out in the summertime. And guys would come from St. Louis and from Cincinnati and from New Orleans to, you know, up to Southampton to hang out for the summers. And after they had gotten, you know, gotten a chance to see this new national that everybody was raving about, the next question was, well, I want one for St. Louis and I want one for Cincinnati. And Stephen McDonald was a Wall Street guy. He's hanging around with J.P. Morgan and the Vanderbilts and those types of folks. And he said, I don't have time to be, you know, doing this all over the world, but I can send my man, Seth Rayner, from, you know, a surveyor and engineer from Southampton, Long Island. And he, you know, he knows what to do. And so Rayner, really, from the day he got into the business, he was busy, you know, and essentially almost, you know, hate to say it, but probably worked himself to death, or at least didn't take care of himself as well as he should have. And so for that reason, he didn't leave much behind other than his work. I mean, there, he didn't write any books. He didn't do very many interviews at all. You know, no one's discovered any, you know, journals that he kept or anything like that. And so, you know, getting back to your question, why, you know, Seth Rayner and what caught my attention, it was really because of the juxtaposition with the courses are so visually striking and so interesting, but there was so little known about the man and his process and stuff. You know, everybody, you know, many of your listeners have probably heard he never played golf in his life. You know, just by chance, the first golf course he ever saw was Shinnecock Hills.
Unbelievable.
17 year old, he helped his father do a site survey for that golf course. And then along comes Steve McDonald, who asked him to help move some dirt and figure out the drainage issues at what will become National Golf Links of America. And then, you know, he was off and running for the next 15 years on just this, you know, wild ride. And somewhere along the line, unfortunately, he forgot to write down all of his secrets. So
I'm interested in how you uncovered all of that. First of all, going back, I was born in Cincinnati, raised outside of Cleveland in a town called Bruxville. I'm going to have to get back to Cincinnati and try to get on one of that, you know, his Seth Rayner design Camargo, yep, as you expressed. But I've lived on the east end of Long Island since the 90s. And yep. Seth Rayner was born in Manorville, not far away from where, yep, I am right now, and lived and worked right in Southampton, as you mentioned. And throughout his, Charles Blair McDonald hired him to build National Golf Links, and he knew nothing about golf.
Yep.
What an interesting scenario, Michael. Yep.
In retrospect, it was kind of a dream team. Stephen McDonald knew plenty about golf, and he was not shy about telling you that he knew a lot about golf. You know, some folks in Yonkers, New York, or in you know, Charleston, South Carolina, or Chicago may disagree, you know, would have disagreed at the time, but he kind of fancied himself the keeper of the flame, right? Charles Blair McDonald literally learned to play golf from old Tom Morris. He was sent over there because his grandfather was a professor at the University of St. Andrews, and he went over there for, you know, as a 16-year-old, most of Chicago had just burned down with the Great Fire. And so as a 16-year-old, they sent him over to St. Andrews to study and you know, kind of get some seasoning in another part of the world. And literally on his second day in town, he went, his grandfather took him down to old Tom Morris's golf shop and, you know, bought him his first set of clubs. And so McDonald really learned the game, you know, at its base, and he was fiercely protective of that. When it came to the United States, he felt like he knew better than anyone, and he wasn't shy about telling people how things should go, whether it was the rules or how competition should be run. And then, you know, later on, as he became wealthier and moved from Chicago to New York, you know, he had this dream that was partially spurred on by a magazine article he read, you know, that was asking the readers to submit, you know, their examples of what they think are the best golf holes in the world. And so you had this very outgoing, sure-footed, a guy who was also a great golfer. Charles Blair McDonald won, you know, U.S. Amateur, the first one held under the USGA's authority. And then partnering with him is this, I think shy is probably too strong a word, but you know, introverted man who was a hard worker, who was polite, who was earnest, and who, you know, was clearly a good listener and was able to, you know, get along with a wide variety of people. You know, golf course architecture, all of us that, you know, are AMs, right? We like to, you know, whether it's in the grill room or at night or we're watching golf on television or whatever, you know, and you, most of us are think that it's, you know, the fun part obviously is getting out the graph paper and drawing, you know, trying to figure out, you know, a new hole design or something. The reality is building a golf course is just backbreaking blue collar work. And so Seth Rayner was the perfect partner for Stephen McDonald in that he was able to bridge the gap between, you know, these really the wealthiest titans of American industry, right? Herbert, you know, Herbert Walker, George Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush's grandfather and great grandfather, you know, for St. Louis Country Club and you know, just all over all the places that he, you know, Stephen McDonald sent him. And he's able to bridge the gap between these ultra wealthy people who knew what they wanted and knew what they expected. But at the same time, you know, it's not like today where Tom Doak's got a crew and Gil Hansen's got a crew. Part of being a good golf architect back then was being able to teach the people in a very relatively short period of time, teach the laborers who many of themselves have never seen a golf course, how to do it, you know, whether it's how to, carry out your instructions on how to shape a green properly, or it's the proper construction of a, sand bunker so that it doesn't all wash out every time it rains. And, you know, we forget that unlike now with Instagram and with, you know, airplanes and modern travel and stuff, many of the courses that Seth Rayner built, Alistair McKenzie built, Harry Colt, whoever, they never actually saw them as golf courses. They were there for 2 or 3 weeks. They did the routing and they maybe taught, you know, the local crew of, you know, just blue collar laborers, day laborers, how to, you know, build one bunker and how to lay out a green. And then, you know, maybe they came back a year later to see how it turned out and maybe not. But Rayner was able to kind of bridge those two worlds of the guys, you know, with the work boots on and the guys in the boardroom who were paying for it all. And he was a good bridge for that. He was a very talented guy for that. Unfortunately, a modest enough man, like I say, that he didn't feel the need to kind of publicize his work or his stuff. And, but to be honest, that's also part of the fun of researching it, writing the book is kind of the hunt is kind of fun too, to, you
know, well, exactly. I mean, you mentioned he did not leave his own writing or any personal reflections. So how did you fill in that gap as far as the historical records?
Yeah. So I stand on the shoulders of a lot of great men and women. That's for sure. Right over in New Jersey at the USGA's headquarters, you've got a great library staff there and they've got the world's largest collection of golf books and research materials. And the ladies that work in the library, Hillary Kronheim and Stacey Schiff, very patient and knowledgeable and helpful and, help you look up things and answer questions and maybe point you in the right direction. There's also, you know, in the last 20 years, there's been a real resurgence, I think, in golf course architecture at large, but specifically with Steve McDonald and then with Seth Rayner. And so there's been more, you know, on the internet and things like that. I mean, trying to write this book 30 years ago would have been impossible without newspapers.com and the web and things like that. And then last but not least is just a lot of dedicated club historians and, you know, outgoing club presidents that have spent, you know, 30 or 40 years of their life at a Metairie Country Club or at a Southampton and took the time to do a club history of their own and did the local research. And depending on how you count, there's about 40 Seth Rayner golf courses left and probably about 35 out of the 40 have got club histories that have been, you know, published within the last 20, 30 years and tracking down copies of those and almost like a book report of what their findings are and seeing how it kind of ties to the other information that I've learned and then trying to build kind of timelines of where he was, when, and, you know, who he was traveling with and things like that to kind of fill in some of the gaps. So
sure. I know Southampton, we just celebrated our centennial anniversary this year and a book will be coming out next year on Southampton. Yeah. So we'll have to get you a copy of that, Michael.
I'm already standing in line. Yeah. You've got a great team up there of Rainerites and I'm looking forward to the book because I know some of the guys involved with it and they do great work and research. I've met some of them at the Seth Rayner Society events and
oh nice.
Yeah, I'm sure
And I don't know if you know, but Southampton, we just got voted Club of the Year by the Met Golf Writers Association at our national awards dinner.
Wow.
In October. So thrilled.
That's a tough neighborhood. You know, that's not like winning that award in Birmingham, Alabama or someplace. That's high cotton up there, as we say. That's a lot of competition there.
Yeah, we were very honored. I mean,
just as one example, Southampton would be the best golf course in Alabama by far. I mean, it would it'd be the best golf course in Louisiana. It'd be the best course in Mississippi. You know, Rainer's career was so brief, and kind of like McKenzie, where, you know, he was only in the United States, you know, you just, the timing had to be right where, you know, there were certain regions of the country where the economy was great and the money was there and the interest was there and the right person was, you know, happened to live nearby or was passing through at the right time. And, you know, Long Island was definitely one of the beneficiaries of that.
Oh my gosh. When you look down the list here, Joseph Seth Rainer's solo designs on the island, West Hampton Country Club, North Shore Country Club. I played Mountain Lake Country Club down in Lake Wales, Florida. We'll talk about that in a second. Brookville Country Club. Let's see, Essex County Country Club. That's in New Jersey. Going down Southampton, of course. Fisher's Island, which is, you know, off the coast, nearby, somewhat reachable by boat. I've played there a few times. And then just in New York overall, I mean, with Sleepy Hollow, the collaboration at Sleepy Hollow, Piping Rock on Long Island, the Creek on Long Island. I mean, it's so rich in Seth Rainer designs or co-designs, and such, this area is so rich in golf history. Talk a little bit, Michael, about, you know, Seth Rainer designs, the template holes, what he is most renowned for.
Yeah. So it really began with C.B. McDonald. He, you know, as I say, he had grown up and did well in Chicago and moved to New York and to the Big Apple. And if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. And he did. I mean, he was running around with, in the roaring 20s when, you know, wasn't much of a better place to be than in Manhattan. And he was part of that crowd. I mean, the membership roster of National Golf Links of America is like reading the, you know, brand names for Fortune 500 companies. I mean, it's just one, you know, whether it's Sears or it's Pfizer or whoever, Merck. So he knew what he knew that he had this dream of building a golf course. And finally, the time was right in his personal life and financially and his circle of friends he knew would support it. So he went, you know, and made trips to. He made a trip to France. He'd made trips to England. He made trips to Scotland, and these were really scouting them. And according to contemporary reports, he took, you know, surveys and measurements of the slopes of the greens. And, you know, he would find a green that he liked or had been recommended to him. And he would try to identify, and it's important for people to know. And we kind of go through this in the book. He didn't build copies of holes. You know, this wasn't like some tourist place down in Myrtle Beach where it's, you know, you can play and they've got a replica of the Spoken Bridge and they've got a replica of the 12th hole at Augusta National. What he was trying to figure out is why these holes were so good. And then when he brought that back and what he taught Seth Rainer was kind of the philosophies of the strategy of the holes and why, you know, what features made them good. And, you know, Rainer obviously was a quick study because what he learned pretty quickly is, you know, there were certain, you know, hole designs or certain features, like you say, we call them templates today. Neither Rainer or McDonald ever used the word template, but they learned how to apply them to different, you know, whether it was different agronomy, different topography. And that's, to me, what's fun. And that's what I think is, I think anybody would enjoy the book if they have the faintest interest in this kind of stuff, because especially with the achievements and advances in modern drone photography and just, you know, private clubs being much less wary about, you know, letting some guy like me through their gates to, you know, have a look around. We're finally able to see these things and see them from different angles and different times of day and things like that. And part of the fun with Seth Rainer is, you know, you've played maybe one when you were growing up, like I say, or you got the caddy at one, or you played in a tournament at one, or you got invited to a member guest at one, and maybe you played a second one. But as you play the third one or the fourth one, it's fun to see different holes that you remember from different Seth Rainer courses and how he applied them to that particular site or that particular topography. You know, you've got Metairie Country Club down in Louisiana. There can't be 3 feet of elevation change. It's flat as a pancake. I mean, dead flat. And so, you know, there he used this, you know, he kind of dialed up the severity of the greens and the slopes and things. And that was kind of the defense, because the rest of it was just kind of a big – you know, essentially just a playground. Whereas you've got Fisher's Island, that's, you know, up and down those hills and trying to, you know, figure out which holes worked best, you know, with some of those greens hanging literally right off the, you know, sides of the beach there, and how to fit the yardages in and how to make them all work. And that really seemed to me to be Rainer's genius was, you know, taking the few things that he knew that he had learned from Steve McDonald. And he doesn't appear to ever really have strayed away from that. He thought this is good. This guy knows what he's doing. I'm busy and the formula is working. But at the same time, he, you know, he never got lazy where he just, you know, pulled a map up off the wall and thought, well, this one worked in New York. Let's try it in, you know, let's try it in Minnesota. He took the time to make every routing and really figure out how to use the holes in the best combinations and different features on different holes. You know, on some holes, like at, you know, like at Fisher's Island, they're, you know, one of their great holes is the Alps hole with the fish with the, you know, which means there's a large mound in between you and the green that you have to hit over. And it's a completely blind shot. And then there's this punch bowl, you know, behind it that kind of helps funnel everything down towards the middle. And it's fun because if you're playing with four people and you're having a little game and everybody hits it over the hill, and then there's this fun moment where everybody's climbing the hill in anticipation.
Right.
And you see, you know, one ball laying right next to the hole and three balls laying 20 feet away. And then it's even funner as you walk down close and you try to figure out whose ball is whose because you don't know, you know, which slope they took because it was a blind shot. There's other places where he used a punch bowl green, you know, on a par three course or on a par three hole or on a par five. You know, he used some of the different strategies in different combinations to make each one of his courses unique. And John Cavalier, who runs Lynx Gems on social media and is a pretty well-known golf photographer. John was our partner on this. And, you know, he takes, I think, just beautiful pictures, but also really unique angles that, you know, you don't see when you're playing. And it really helps kind of show off what makes, you know, each one unique. And that's kind of how we approached the book was.
Right. I mean, John said it was the most fun photographing Seth Rainer designs because they're just fun holes. They're
fun.
As you said, the punch bowl, every punch bowl is somewhat similar to all these, but so a little different, as you say, right? I know it's Southampton, it's 16, and there's a huge mound in front of the green, and you can't, basically, you can't see the landing area, right? And you go for, they have a little target, you know, thing behind the green, so you kind of aim for that, and it's just so much fun. Where is the ball going to land? You don't know until you kind of have a view of it. So
he was able
the
to,
photographer was able to really capture the essence of those holes.
He was. And, you know, Rainer was clever enough to make each one of his courses feel unique, even though essentially there are about 22 different, you know, today we call them templates or concepts that he would use in different combinations. But all the courses are fun. They're also all, you know, most of them are very walkable, except for some of the more extreme sites where there just wasn't an easy answer to solve an issue. And at most places you could play them, you know, you could play golf there 7 days in a row with one sleeve of balls. You know, there's just, it was not a penal type of situation. It was risk reward. You know, it was, if you want to try to carry a bunker or if you want to try to take a shortcut over a dog leg and you are successful, you're going to be paid off for it. But if you're a beginner golfer or if you're a 10-year-old who's just learning how to play and you're out there with, you know, your dad getting to play the big course, you could hit seven irons, 130 yards, you know, as long as you're hitting them straight and never lose a ball and have a great time. Because, as you said, the challenges that he presents are pretty easy to understand. You know, they're pretty easy visually to grasp. You know, when you're playing a Redan hole or you're playing a Biarritz, you can walk up to it, even if it's the first Seth Rainer golf course you've ever played. It's pretty easy to catch on what challenge is put ahead of you and what your options are. And those are usually pretty easy to grasp.
And that first Biarritz hole in the United States was built at Piping Rock back in 1911. And
right.
I understand that Charles Blair McDonald actually perhaps named it after a hole he saw in the south of France or.
Yes. Yeah, so a little bit of controversy in that one. So Biarritz, France is, it's kind of a, like the Southampton of France. It's where everybody goes in the summer to escape the heat. And especially in the days before, you know, before highways and before air conditioning and all that kind of stuff. So it's been a well-known resort for, you know, going back over 100 years. And there was, again, there's different versions of the story, but there was a relatively famous hole there that was almost if you can kind of picture the 16th at Cypress Point. It was called the Chasm Hole. And if anybody's ever lucky enough to be invited to the Lynx Club in downtown New York City, which was kind of Stephen McDonald's in-town club, it's like golf clubhouse, but
right,
it's
that's
on
a
the Upper
cool
East Side.
Spot for sure.
Yeah, there's a painting of the Chasm Hole. I think the most commonly accepted feeling today is that he got the idea for kind of the long force carry from the Chasm Hole, but then there was another hole or another green site probably down on the beach, you know, below the cliff down there, where he kind of got the idea for the swale. Also important to note, for the real aficionados, they already know this, but so the Biarritz holes, it was never intended that there was green in front. So right now, you know, they can put the pin in front of the swale or behind the swale. In the original versions of almost all the holes, we think every one of the holes, the front was not cut to green height. So the pin was always back, and you always had to run the ball through the swale in the green.
Right. That number 14 Biarritz hole at Southampton is tricky. And
yeah.
You know, it's so much fun because the hole takes on so many different options depending on where they put the pin. And then the maiden, number 3 at Southampton, the blind tee shot, you have two pronounced plateaus on the green. Yep. Talk a little bit about the maiden template.
Yeah, so that's I think so in the book, to kind of explain it to folks new to it, or if you've only played one, or maybe you're excited because you've got an invite to play one coming up and you want to learn a little bit about it before you go. In each chapter of the book, or as I preview courses, I pick a different example of what I think is, you know, a notable example of each one of the 22 different, you know, what we call today, we call template holes.
Sure.
In Point them out. And so for Southampton, I chose the maiden hole. I think the maiden is, I think the Southampton's version of the maiden is right up there with anybody's.
Classic.
Maidens were usually one of the harder holes on the golf course. They were typically, not always, there's, you know, there are very few firm and, you know, set in stone rules with McDonald or Rayner. Cause like I say, they try to keep an open mind and adapt to what they found when they arrived at a new web. You know, they didn't try to impose a golf course, you know, before they saw the land, they, you know, they walked the land and saw what was available and how the different pieces might fit together like a puzzle when they were doing the routing. But typically in most cases, maiden holes were longer par fours. As you say, it's, you know, they have a lot in common with the double plateau green, which is one where there's, you know, it's almost like an L shape and two of the sides are either much higher than the middle or much lower than the middle. So it's almost like it's three different greens. The maiden hole, typically there's a back right shelf and a back left shelf, as you say, and then kind of a little trench running through the middle. I like the one at Southampton because you got that little bunker. If it runs all the way through the back of it and, you know, on longer par fours, you know, a lot of times you're coming in with a 4 iron or a 5 iron or whatever. And if you catch a little thin, or if you just don't have your distance right, or you're, you know, one reason or another, it's easy to run a ball through there. And I like how that little bunker at Southampton kind of collects everything. But yeah, I'd say the maiden, generally speaking, is one of the harder holes at a lot of the sixth round golf courses. The maiden is one of the
green complexes are just, you know,
yeah, they're fun,
beautiful, they're fun, but they're tough, very, very tough. And then, of course, the Rodin holes, just classic design. And at Southampton, it's number 7. You have that huge right to left slope on the green, just so much fun. You have to place that tee shot perfectly to get that roll right there near to the hole, right? It's just a brilliant, brilliant template hole.
Yeah, they learned, you know, they knew back then what we've forgotten too often in modern golf, which is one of the fun parts about golf is watching the ball rolling on the ground. You know, I mean, it's exciting when you hit a good shot on whether it's on a maiden hole or on a Biarritz or wherever, and the ball disappears for a second and you're wondering, you know, is it going to come through? Or when you have to hit a ball over a hill and, you know, you're playing a match against somebody and you go up there and there's only one ball on the green and there's one ball in the bunker. And when you're walking up, you're hoping it's his ball in the bunker and your ball, you know, on the green. And he's thinking the opposite. You know, that excitement and that, you know, suspended, you know, moment when you're waiting. And I think a lot of that somewhere along the line, unfortunately, kind of got lost with, you know, as courses got built more for, you know, real estate sales and things like that. And, you know, which presented drainage issues and runoff issues, and that led to more water hazards, and I could go on and on. But there's not much fun about hitting a ball in a lake, you know, and it just being gone. And then you got to reach in your bag and get another ball. And if you got to do that four or five times, that's a pretty easy way to turn people off of golf. Everybody likes watching your ball as it rolls closer and closer to the hole, and you're hoping it'll stop rolling as it, you know, as it gets near, you know, as near to the hole as you can. That's a fun thing. Or as the ball takes a slope, I'm a double digit handicap these days, but I can't do it 10 times in a round, but even just once or twice, it's fun. And I think it's something for beginners too. I personally think that a lot of Seth Rayner and Stephen McDonald golf courses are fun places to play as a beginner.
They are so much fun. And you know, yeah, some of the most memorable moments are when I birdied that Rodin hole at Southampton just recently. I mean, just to place it perfectly on that slope and see it trickle down close to the hole. Can you imagine getting a hole in one on that hole? That'd be classic. We're talking to Michael Wolff, the author of The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. We're going to take a quick break and come back. I have a couple more questions I want to ask you, Michael, so stay where you are. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and we continue with my conversation with Michael Wolff, who, along with Jim Sitar, wrote The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. And boy, learning so much about Seth Rayner and your passion for this renowned golf course architect. And we are talking about his template holes. Which Rayner hole, if any, would you say best describes his genius of all those template holes that we previously talked about?
Yeah, I like a good Alps hole. They're typically, not the longest hole. They're usually, a little bit shorter. They're quirky. They'll often have kind of a, not just a blind shot for the approach to the green, but a blind shot with a bunker hidden on the other side of the hill. So not only do you have to clear the hill, or whatever's in front of you, a mound that they built or whatever, but a lot of times there's a hazard on the back side of that, on the side that you can't even see, the downslope, I guess you'd say, and then the punch bowl green. They're fun. They typically, one of the tricks that Rayner learned from McDonald, and McDonald was said to have, it's one of the first locations he identified for a hole when he was laying out National Golf Links America. They typically build them uphill because it kind of helps with the challenge of the second shot. If you're playing an Alps that was downhill, you'd be able to see over the hazard in front of the green. Whereas this one, by going uphill, it kind of exacerbates that. They don't have to move as much dirt that way. And they can kind of tuck it in, into a corner of the property or whatever.
Wasn't it originally modeled after the Alps hole at Prestwick, which
was
such a whimsical golf course. Yeah. I love that golf course. I played Prestwick in Scotland a number of years ago, and oh my gosh, but that was obviously the inspiration for McDonald.
It was. And I think one of the funny things about if they hadn't done it and somebody created the Alps hole today on some course in, Florida or in Kentucky somewhere, people would hate it. They'd be like, this is a crazy hole. You can't see where you're going. It's, you can't tell when the people in front of you are getting off the green, whatever. But the fact that it has its roots at Prestwick, and then it was picked up by Stephen McDonald and brought over here and, recreated at, just wonderful places like Fisher's Island and Southampton and all over the place. For some reason, we as golfers, like, that's got our seal of approval. As long as those guys said it was okay, then it must be okay.
Exactly. Whereas, well, Prestwick, my God, anything at Prestwick, is just incredible. Yeah. But so what would be your top three Rayner designs that you would recommend to Rayner enthusiasts?
Well, getting on them is the hard part. I mean, so Fisher's Island, obviously, there aren't many better places. For those that don't know, as you reference, it's this tiny island that's out in the coast of Connecticut. And that's kind of part of the charm, is you take a little, whaler out there. And there's, a couple of hundred residents on the island in the summertime. But the golf course, it looks like an island that was built with a golf course in mind. I mean, the holes and the way he put them on there is it's like the perfect distances around the shoreline. I think 13 of the 14 have 13 holes out of the 18 touch the shoreline at some point.
Have usable water.
And the views are just, you know, beautiful, and you get a little breeze, and you get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich at the turn that they make pretty good ones there. And it's just a wonderful place
I
to,
can't think of a more special golf memory, really, than taking the boat over there and you dock it on the 17th area. They send you the carts and away you go. I mean, that's a special memory that, you know, I've been blessed to have that opportunity a couple of times, Michael. That is spectacular. So, okay, so Fisher Island would be one of your. What about the two others?
I'm going to say Chicago Golf.
I'd love to play that.
And there's
Haven't
a
played that one.
unique backstory there that it couldn't be more different from as far as the setting from Fisher's Island. It's when you pull up, it looks like a field. I mean, it's Chicago Golf, but it's in Wheaton, Illinois. It's with traffic, it'd take you an hour to get out, you know, hour and a half to get out there, you know, from what we think of as downtown Chicago. It's just this field that has been sitting out there, but it is the, you know, as much as any place, it can stake a claim to, you know, one of the early birthplaces of golf in the United States. Steve McDonald laid the course out originally. It's a square piece of property with some subtle land movement, but certainly nothing like a Yale or a National Golf Links of America or Fisher's Island and like that. It's you know, at first glance, it can look like a field, but there's a lot more to it than that. And it's seen a lot over the years. I mean, it was one of the, you know, early, it hosted, you know, a bunch of USGA, US Amateur, US
Sure.
Opens, you know, very early on. So all the greats have been there. It hosted a Walker Cup recently. It's going to host another Walker Cup in about 15 years. It hosted the first ever women's senior open, first one that when the USGA founded that, whatever that was, 4 years ago now, 5 years
Yeah,
ago.
I love that.
Chicago Golf. And so you feel the real history there. But I also like the connection that when you go, you have to see a letter that's framed and hanging kind of on the downstairs hallway. So McDonald had left Chicago and moved to Manhattan in New York. And they were asking him for some advice because they were starting to feel like, you know, story as old as time, that their course was getting outdated with changes in distance and how good the players were getting, and they were worried they were kind of being left behind. So they asked for McDonald for advice, and he sent them this letter they have hanging in the hallway. My friend John Moran, who's the club historian there, does a great job kind of showcasing their history. And the letter basically says, "Your course stinks. I know I'm the one that built it, but I didn't know what I was doing back then. And so I'm going to send my guy Seth Rayner, and
Wow.
please don't bug him. Let him work for a couple of days, you know, in quit pestering him. And I promise you, if you just let him work after, you know, the week's up when he's been there, he'll give you a plan for something that can bring your golf club back to a relevance." And you know, I just like everything about that. The fact that
That's
it's such a
hysterical.
McDonald thing to say. He complained about everything, including his own work. So, because he knew something was better.
And
And
where is that hanging up? Where in Chicago Golf
it's
Club?
kind of downstairs and kind of at the bottom of the staircase,
Oh,
the
that's
downstairs
classic. It's worth going
hall.
just to read that
Yeah.
letter, right? Take a picture of
Yeah.
that
Or
letter. Oh my gosh.
if you can get a copy. So, as I said, John Moran, he wrote an updated club history, not a club history, but a golf course history for Chicago Golf's golf course. And it was the winner of the 2024 USGA's Herbert Warren Wynn Book Prize. So
Nice.
it was the best golf book anybody wrote last year. And John's a deserving recipient of that. So,
Sure. And what would be your number three? You have Fisher Island, you have Chicago Golf Club, and number three, I know
number
it's like
three. So
picking your favorite children.
I better say Essex County Country Club because
Oh.
I'm working on a book for them right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Essex County is kind of an interesting case study. They wanted two golf courses, so they already had a golf course. They had acquired some land on top of a mountain nearby, and they decided to move the location. Like a lot of clubs in kind of the late 1800s, early 1900s, they had outgrown their old place that they had polo and fox hunting and all that. They wanted a new place, and they decided 36 holes. So Tillinghast built the first 18-hole golf course for them, but then they were able to acquire another kind of crucial piece of land that was adjoining, and they decided Tillinghast wasn't available, and so they called up Seth Rayner because, you know, New York, and he's working in the neighborhood. And so Rayner, along with his assistant Charles Banks, they designed 36 holes for him. And I think there's a couple things special about it. One, just the fact that Tillinghast was there, and then Rayner, and then after Rayner's death, Banks completed it. But also, it's the only place where they built two golf courses. And both of them have the template holes and things. Besides his connections to Steve McDonald, another important introduction for Rayner was the Olmsted brothers. So the Olmsted brothers were, it was a design firm that did architectural landscaping, and they essentially in the United States invented the business of architectural landscaping. They, the original Olmsted helped design Central Park. He designed the Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C. around the, on, around the U.S. Capitol and the Supreme Court and all that. He was involved in real estate, you know, developments and kind of planned communities all over. And he and Rayner had a great relationship with him. And so whether it was like Fisher's Island, Mountain Lake, all those are Olmsted, right. Yeaman's Hall, all those are Olmsted sites. And at most of Olmsted sites, they would design 36 holes. And the idea was you'd build the big course first to attract the men who would buy the houses and move their families there. But as they sold more lots and as the neighborhood filled up and the course got busier, they wanted a second golf course. So they would have Rayner design a second course, which would typically be a little bit shorter. And the idea would be, but it would still have, you know, maybe not all 18 template holes, but it would have a, you know, half dozen or, you know, whatever. But like I say, a little bit more of a, at least on paper, a little bit more of a dialed down version maybe. And the thought was, is golf became more popular and as the neighborhood filled up, that's where you would put the beginners so they wouldn't slow down the experts. And so if you go to Yeaman's Hall, if you go to Fisher's Island, there's a lot of times when you see the routing maps, Fisher's Island, if you can believe it, there were there he routed another golf course. There were supposed to be two golf courses, supposed to be two golf courses at Yeaman's Hall. You know, none of those plans, there were supposed to be two golf courses at Gibson Island. None of those went through. All of them, you know, they got one done and then the Great Depression and that's what everything ground to a halt. But the
only what great background. And you, yeah, as you mentioned, the Olmsted family, we had the opportunity to play Mountain Lake Country Club in Lake Wales earlier in the year. And apparently the Ruth family, they tried to hire Donald Ross to build that golf course, right? And Donald Ross was not available. So in comes Seth Rayner, and that's a gorgeous design in the middle of Florida, of all places, right?
And I guess I hope I'm getting this story right. I read it a while back, but so Fisher's Island was just a potato farm for, you know, most of his life. And the real estate was kind of considered, you know, not a great plot of land because you had to take a boat out to it. And so it was cost prohibitive to do any farming out there. And it wasn't until they saw Mountain Lake kind of in the middle of nowhere, they realized, hey, maybe something like this would work. But instead of, you know, this community in the middle of central Florida, we could build it on our island and have, you know, have a church there and have 150 or 200 homes or whatever, and a little elementary school and a golf course. And if they can make it work in Florida, and that was kind of, I believe that that's I'm getting those, the order of those right. But anyway, yeah, I'd say I just like kind of this at Essex County. It's kind of a unassuming place. It's a place where you can have a, you know, a cold beer afterwards and feel right at home, even if you're, you know, not from the neighborhood. The other thing I like about, as you mentioned with Long Island, that area around Essex County, Morris County is another real hotbed for Rayner. I mean, you've got Rock Spring, which is one of the few public Rayner courses. It started as a private club, but it's a, you know, it's a municipal course now. So if anybody wants to play a Seth Rayner golf course near New York City and you don't have any connections, that's a place to go. Morris County Country Club, which hosted, you know, first, you know, it was the first country club in the United States, started and run entirely by women. It held
History too.
Very earliest women's U.S. Opens. And, you know, it's got as much history as anybody. That's right down the street. So there's probably six Seth Rayner golf courses within, I don't know, 10 miles of each other right there in New Jersey. So
busy guy. He did such brilliant work in such a short period of time. Obviously died so young, 51, back in 1926. My last question to you, Michael, we could go on and on, but looking back on this project, what is one question you would have wanted to ask Seth Rayner if he were alive?
Well, I mean, as you can see from my background with my books, my first question would be, where's the book? Because there's this holy grail kind of Indiana Jones thing among golf architecture nerds like myself, that it's known that Stephen McDonald took extensive notes when he made his kind of scouting trips over to Scotland and France and England. for these courses. And like I say, it was detailed observations of kind of not just, oh, the green slopes back to front, but what's the perfect, you know, slope for a ball to roll, or, you know, well hit shot to stop, but a you know, poorly struck shot to roll off. Is it 3 degrees of slope? Is it 4 degrees? He was one of the first ones that kind of really try to, I think, document some of that stuff. And he supposedly had this book. He passed it along to Seth Rayner. It's not known after Rayner died. Charles Banks was kind of, you know, Charles Banks was to Rayner what Rayner was to Stephen McDonald. Nobody knows where the book is. Nobody's seen the book, and there's no photos or really detailed description. So I think my first question would be, you know, where's the book? I think the other one would just be, I just like to listen, you know, I just like to listen and talk. I mean, he was a volunteer firefighter, you know, when he wasn't working in Southampton as the town engineer, you know, he was on the volunteer firefighting crew, and he's just this local boy. And I mean, this is 1915, Southampton wasn't, you know, what it is today. That's for sure. It was, you know, Long Island Expressway hadn't come along, and to go from that to suddenly building golf courses for McDonald's friends all over the country, it was just such a whirlwind. And it was something that he hadn't aspired to, you know, he wasn't a golfer. He'd never played golf in his life. And so I think I'd just like to hear him talk about that 10 years of, you know, did he ever have time to kind of catch his breath and just think like, what am I getting? Like, how did this all happen? You know?
Right. I'm sure he has no idea, or had no idea back then, just how prolific and iconic he and his design work would become. No idea. What a genius. What a, just a true artist. And it's so wonderful to talk to you, Michael, and to appreciate the genius of Seth Rayner. Thank you so much. Continued success with the book, The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thanks for spending some time with me on Sports Interview.
Yeah, happy to do it. And we do have a few copies left. So if anybody wants one, we sell them directly on our own website. So it's Back 9 Press. With 9 as the number. So BACK, the number 9, and then PRESS. And that way we don't have to give Amazon, they're cutting all that stuff. We don't have many left, but we do have a few. So if anybody's dying to have one, we'll try to make sure you can get your hands on one before they're gone. So
tell me the website one more time.
Back 9 Press. And they've got all kinds of great golf books on there. Jim Sitar, my partner on this project, he's the publisher of Back 9. So it's Back 9 Press, BACK, the number 9, and then PRESS. And they've got all kinds of goodies on there if you'd like reading about golf.
Thanks so much, Michael Wolf, the Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by IB Cool Athleisure Wear for men and women. Technology meets fashion with IB Cool, stylish UPF 50 plus sun protection, and ice field technology to cool your body temperature on hot and humid days. Look great and protect your skin. IBKUL.com. And by Tourism Ireland. Ireland is open and ready to welcome you back. World-class courses, celebrated links, spectacular scenery, rich culture, and the warmest of welcomes await. Now is the time to get back to the things that matter most. Now is the time for Ireland. Press the green button and start planning at ireland.com/golf.